The Buddha looked at life and he saw that there was a lot of suffering, a lot of stress, a lot of suffering in it. There's sorrow, lamentation, grief, despair. He taught us that there would be the sadness of losing the people we love, the irritation of being with people we don't love. We'd not get the things we want often and wind up with lots of things that we don't want. And on top of that, there is, of course, the big fears. There's the inevitable truths of aging, sickness, and death, which were the great messengers that the Buddha saw and spurred him on to his spiritual path. So we all have to deal with this constant landscape of change that's going on in our life. The body is getting older, friends move away, we don't get the things we want. A lot of our strategy for finding happiness is to, what the Buddha said, cling onto things that can give us a sense of stability, a sense of permanence, a sense of security. And, of course, the problem is rather than bringing these things, peace, tranquility, security, so many of the things that we attach to actually do just the opposite. We tend to attach to things that bring us peace, security, happiness for a short period of time. Whether we're talking about alcohol or crack, careers and jobs, relationships, food, whatever it is that so many of us make our happiness contingent on. It's totally natural to reach out into the world. The Buddha used actually the word upadana, which doesn't really mean cling. It's sort of an awkward translation. The word upadana actually means to feed. He said that the mind feeds off of the world trying to find security and happiness. When we feel alone, or there's not a lot of people in our lives, some of us turn on the television, which gives the illusion that there's lots of people there, that there's people in our lives. And so the mind feeds off of the television for the feeling that there's other people in my life. And of course, this strategy works in the short term. We don't feel this feeling of emptiness and loneliness. For a little while, we feel there's someone else there. So, as a short-term strategy, it works. Sometimes we feel uncomfortable in our own bodies. We feel stressed out. And what many people do is they take the edge off. They light up a joint. They have a few brewskis. They do whatever it takes. Pop a couple of Ativans, Xanax, whatever. Of course, just like the television set or so many of our other strategies, these things work in the short term, but in the long term, they don't address the underlying conditions which cause the discomfort. There's loneliness, there's disconnectedness, there's feeling uncomfortable, there's all these things. So I thought I'd give a talk tonight about one of my favorite teachings by the Buddha about the strategies that we use that cause this great fear of dying, the fear of death. There's a couple of teachings where the Buddha addressed the fear of death, and he said that actually that the fear of death is not something that is inevitable. Contrary to our innate belief that certain forms of suffering and fear and sadness are natural, completely given, and that we can't escape them, while there is certainly something natural about it, the mind is set up to certainly cling to external reality rather than to inner peace. The mind is a very fearful, frantic thing that tends to focus on things in the world to try to distract it or give it a sense of security where there is none. So there is, to some extent, a natural tendency to cause ourselves suffering by clinging to the wrong things. Now, this teaching is called the Abhaya Sutta, and there was a Brahmin. And the Brahmin's name was Yanusonen. And Yanusonen, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, so don't go to any of the monks that are visiting and say, Josh told the story of Yanusonen, because they'll probably faint, because whenever I pronounce a Pali word to Ajahn Jeff, you can see him get pale and start sweating. But this Brahmin came to the Buddha, and basically you can, if you read a lot of the Pali Canon, you get to pick up these little insights from the way each sutta is written. And when somebody just goes up to the Buddha and doesn't pay him any respect and just immediately asks a question, it's sort of the text's way of saying that this is not a very friendly person. It's somebody who was from another path, and they really wanted to fuck with him. They're like, yo, fuck you, man. fucking take this Buddha. So Yanusonen goes up and he's like, yo, there ain't nobody. Now, that's not what it says in the text, but ain't nobody that ain't frightened of death. They're all frightened of death. That's what's going on. He says, we are all frightened of death. That is what is the nature of you. What you're teaching isn't so good, because everybody at the end is terrified of dying, right? So this is a direct challenge to what the Buddha is teaching. This guy is basically obviously concerned that the Buddha is onto something, and that it might be a threat to Brahmanism. So the Buddha responds. He says, in fact, there are many people who are terrified of dying, and there are people who aren't terrified of dying. And he goes on to list what kinds of people are frightened of dying and why, and what kinds of people aren't frightened of dying and why they are. I'm going to read you a little of it. This is my translation from the Pali. So the Buddha says there are those who, subject to death, are afraid, and there are those who aren't afraid. This is the Buddha talking. What kind of person is afraid? Well, the first is one who hasn't abandoned craving for sensual pleasures. As this person becomes sick, the thought occurs, my pleasures are being taken away from me. And so this person grieves and suffers. This person is subject to the terror of death. And then there is the person who has not abandoned attachment to the body, very attached to their body. As this person becomes sick, the thought occurs, my body is taken from me. And so this person grieves and suffers and is terrified of death. And then there's the person who has done harmful, cruel actions. This person becomes old and sick, and terrible thoughts attack him. Thoughts of, I have not done what is good, I have been bad, I am not a good person, etc. And so this person is terrified of dying. And finally, there's the person who, due to doubt and confusion, has never experienced the release that the Dhamma brings through spiritual practice, i.e. the release through meditation and through spiritual practice. So those are the four kinds of ways that we create fear of death for ourselves. And then he said there are those who aren't afraid of death. And of course it's the exact opposite. He goes on to say, someone who is let go of their craving for sensual pleasures, someone who is not attached overly to the body, someone who has not done cruel actions, and someone who has experienced true peace through their spiritual practice, will not be terrified of death. So let's take them one by one, and then I'll give some of the anecdotes or how to put this into practice. The first, attachment to sensual pleasures or to, you know, pleasant sights, sounds, thoughts. As we grow older, it's hard for all of you young folks to know this. You're all so young and pretty. But as we get older, it becomes harder and harder and harder to get laid, enjoy getting laid. The sensual pleasures of acquiring things become diminished. I remember over the course of my parents' life, eventually, as they became older and older and older, eventually they didn't really want anything, especially my mom. People who get to a certain point, there's just the only thing some people want is just to have money, but they actually, the joy that comes from acquiring or from having or from the sensual pleasures begins to ebb away because the brain just doesn't produce as much dopamine. The joy that comes from the dopamine rush of searching and finding and acquiring becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. There is this sense of having done it all before and realizing how short the pleasures that come from eating, imbibing, consuming less. Think of how much time we spend planning what we're going to eat for dinner as opposed to how long the actual pleasure of eating generally is. Eating and the taste of the food goes very quickly. But we spend so much time thinking, wow, I can't wait till I get something to eat. That's going to solve everything today. Or whatever, as soon as I get this bigger apartment or as soon as I get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, we plan our happiness on these sensual pleasures. And then when we get them, the next day we wake up and there's another craving that's taken its place. So the pleasures we experience over life, we eventually begin to experience this dissatisfaction with the things that we've been craving. And generally, people will then crave other things for a while. They realize that their lasting happiness is not going to come from their career, perhaps. And so they become obsessed with their children, their family, or perhaps writing their memoirs. They look for a sense of lasting security and meaning to their life from somewhere else. And then when that doesn't give them lasting security and peace, they look somewhere else and somewhere else. This constant attaching to sensual experiences for security and happiness, the Buddha says, keeps the mind looking around, searching. Always this feeling of there's something missing. Because the very action of constantly looking outside of the mind, outside in the world of possessions and people and careers and all that, for lasting happiness. There's nothing wrong with enjoying your careers. There's nothing wrong with falling in love. There's nothing wrong with enjoying your apartments. But when we're looking for the lasting security and happiness that is really that thing that we're looking for from life, if we try to find it in those things, we will feel there's something missing within because we're constantly looking for things outside of ourselves. And so we eventually go through the practice of the path of dying frantically because we haven't found that thing that gives us a lasting sense of meaning and security and peace and tranquility. The mind goes into the idea of death agitated. I remember my dad. He went through a bizarre phase as he was in the assisted living facility before he died. And he just became fixated with how much money he had. And each day he'd want me to go and print out his bank account and show him this to give this feeling that there was something there that he could hold on to. It was very, very sad. And I remember, I spent the last... My mom was in a hospital for the last 10 years of her life. My dad was in a facility for the last 7 years. So I was basically every week seeing people die for 10 years. And you could see people who were going into this phase of their life at peace, and people who were going into this phase of their life with fear and agitation and horror and denial. And there is no doubt in my mind, I can tell you from absolute experience, that the thing that determines what attitude we go towards death is totally denied. Completely. It's not something that's a given. It's not something that, you know, certain people are just born, you know, at peace and other people aren't. It's not the way it works. Our entire lives, the decisions we make, the actions we take, lead to this place in our lives. Now, of course, the second attachment to the body, if there's anything we're going to attach to that's going to be less than satisfactory eventually, it's your body. I hate to break it to you, but I'm in my 40s, and let me tell you, every day I wake up and there's a new thing to despair about. You know, you look in the mirror and you're like, oh my God. And the results of exercise are, you know, not as immediately clear. And when, I accidentally kicked something with my toe, it takes twice as long to, there's just a seeing physically that the body is a biological entity that is, its very nature is to fall apart. That's its very nature. Its nature is to come together and then to fall apart. And I've met people who, you know, go through these operations and these procedures to try to hide that fact. And as a society, we love to run away from death and aging. The actors and actresses on TV are invariably young and pretty. The institutions we have, we hide the sick in hospitals. We immediately get rid of the dead in morgues. We immediately, you know, we turn away from these inevitabilities. So we train ourselves not to see this, but it's happening all the time. And if we attach to the body for a sense of happiness, it leads to such, I can tell you, it leads to a lot of disappointment. Also, of course, if our actions are cruel to other people or to ourselves, that is the mind we live in. It's not just a teaching about guilt that the Buddha is teaching here. He's basically saying that when we act cruelly, when we act with indifference, when we don't care about others, then that is the mind we live in. And when we go through the process of sickness or aging or death, that's the mind we're going to live in. A mind that's been cruel. A mind that's been indifferent. A mind that has never practiced compassion. The mind that we want to be in when we're going through that part of our lives has got to be one of compassion and patience and kindness. Because when you see that process of the body and life ending, it's one of everything being stripped away. It is not a pretty picture. Death is not something to celebrate or feel good about. It's very, very sad. It's watching the last, often people's last shreds of pride, if they have any pride in their ability to do things physically, that gets taken away. I remember my dad was a very physical man before he died. You know, I had to do the toilet stuff for him. I had to clean him. I had to, all that stuff. It was taken from him. He had to come to a place where he had to live without every last shred of what he would consider to be dignity. So thankfully, the Buddha's path is not just one of accepting aging, sickness, and death. The Buddha offered something in return. He said that there is a way to find lasting peace, what he called the deathless, a way of finding a happiness that was completely guaranteed. This happiness, the Buddha said, doesn't come from attaching to the things that we normally feed off, the mind feeds off of. It's not something like acquiring or consuming. The two parts of creating this lasting peace are, first, creating a place inside that's calm and peaceful, that we, without any contingency or dependence on anyone else or anything else, can at all times cultivate. That's why we practice meditation. Not only so that we can bring peace to our lives today, not only so that we can bring calm today, but imagine what it will be like when the things that we take for granted now are taken away. What will you need then to bring peace as the things that we consider to be given are not given to us anymore? So the Buddha taught that it's crucial to develop this practice of cultivating mindfulness, which remembering to calm the body, to calm the mind, to use the breath and to use the mind's ability to influence the body through thinking thoughts such as loving kindness. I've made a printout of some chants or meditation prayers as well that Theravadan monks recite. So there is a way. And the second way is also part of it, is also working with actions that undermine our tendency to cling and look for happiness by controlling. These actions are actions of generosity, goodwill, being compassionate with others. By doing that, we're not just giving away. Generosity, being compassionate, giving your time to someone, helping someone when you can, calling someone or being interested when somebody needs just someone to listen to them. These are not just giving. The Buddha says that there's actually no just giving to it, because we're getting in return. What we're getting is a sense of not only self-esteem, but a sense of inner buoyancy. We're creating a mind that when we go through the process of aging and sickness, will be a mind that was generous, was compassionate, was appreciative. Wouldn't you rather be in that mind at that time of life than be in a mind that was judgmental and harsh with people, was never satisfied with others? Because that kind of mind is what you'll be in when you go through your sickness. If you were never satisfied with others, you will not be satisfied with your life. But if you have practiced appreciation of others when you go through the period of letting go that old age and sickness requires, you will have appreciated your own life and your own actions, because that's the mind you'll have created. That's the true gift of spiritual practice. It's not immediate. It's not immediate. Right now, the pleasure of meditation might not be obvious to you. The pleasure of being generous might not be obvious to you. The pleasure of being compassionate might not be obvious to you. But when the time counts, it will. Because you will live in the mind that you have constructed. Now, to work with these teachings, the Buddha came up with a couple of recollections. His most famous, which he taught that all lay practitioners should practice, and what I've been practicing for years, is the five recollections. I've made a printout of some other Theravadan meditations, which we'll do at the very end of the class. But the five recollections are the following. Now, this is going to sound a little harsh. They're not upbeat thoughts. But the fifth one actually is much more upbeat than you will think when I recite it to you. So the Buddha recommended that all lay practitioners and all monks recite the following. I am of the nature to grow old. I am of the nature to become sick. I am of the nature to die. Everyone and everything that I love, I will be separated from. I am dependent on and live in the consequences of all of my actions. Now, the first four are fucking bummers. No two way around it. They are meant to cultivate a sense of, hey, wait a second, I'm over-relying on my girlfriend, my boyfriend, my job, my possessions, my body, my this, my that, to bring me lasting peace. I'm over-relying on them. It's a reminder. It's building up what the Buddha called samvega, which is a sense of discouragement and where we are placing all of our marbles or all of our, what's the eggs? We're placing all of our eggs, our marbles, our
eggs
chips.
In the basket.
Eggs in the basket? That's right, eggs in the basket. So we're placing all the... placing all our marbles in the nest. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. So anyway. Anyway, so... So it's to remind us of that. But the fifth one, I am dependent upon and live in the consequences of all of my actions. That's actually reminding us that if my actions are based on, I like to remember the three G's, generosity, goodwill, and gratitude. Yes. Gratitude. Then I am preparing, creating a mind that I will live in the consequences of. It's not just bad. Whenever we hear the word consequences, we tend to go, oh, ooh, ooh. There's this idea that in our, we use karma to almost invariably mean something negative. But karma was never meant to be an invariably negative or positive teaching. Karma is simply a psychological understanding that the actions and thoughts we have consequences. If we think thoughts of generosity, gratitude, compassion, goodwill, if we are patient, if we develop concentration skills so that we can focus on things that bring us peace, then we will live in comfortable minds. There are consequences, and many of the consequences are, all the consequences are in line with the quality of the actions. So if we act skillfully, we will live in a skillful mind. Period. That is karma. That's all it is. It's not about you steal a dollar from somebody and then somebody will, in the next lifetime, steal $5 from you. Or if you look at a dog, that a dog will bite you. Or I don't know what these ridiculous... It's a psychological insight. The kinds of actions that we participate in, the thoughts that we have, create the mind that we're going to live in. It's that simple. So it's a great promise that if we want to have the kind of mind that is of peace, that is generous, that is compassionate, we practice those things now with ourselves and other people, because that is, these actions, these thoughts are constructing the mind that we will be in when really the greatest tests of life are put before us. So the other thing that the Buddha taught, and I'm going to do it at the very end, I'm just going to mention it, is that when preparing the mind also for death, the Buddha often taught about feeling gratitude for our skillful actions and for the beneficial things that we have done. So one of the meditations I'm going to leave at the end tonight is a gratitude meditation. I'm also going to give a handout of a printout of the Theravadin gratitude chants and the chants that are done on the recollection of death. So that's my talk for tonight. I hope you got something out of it, and now is your turn to ask any question about anything related to spiritual practice. Okay, so closing the eyes, take a deep breath in and let it all out, letting go of everything you've heard tonight. Bring your awareness into a part of the body that feels good and find again a comfortable breath. You can ask again your body what kind of breath would feel good. So remembering that lasting happiness comes from within. There's nothing wrong with wishing ourselves happiness or peace, because these are states that do not take anything away from anyone else. When we're truly happy, we share this happiness with others. We don't hoard it, because there's an endless supply. May I be peaceful. May I be truly happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be truly happy. Now bringing to mind the sense of appreciation. If on this day or in the past I have done good, I call these actions to mind now that my heart may rejoice. If on this day or in the past I have done good, I call these actions to mind so that my heart may rejoice. Hello? I rejoice in my own good deeds, resolving not to compare myself with others. Rejoice in my own good deeds and gladly share my joy with all beings everywhere. Just try to bring to mind one good thing you've done recently to help someone. Perhaps a good thought that you thought of someone, or a time that you reached out. And let this feeling of a sense of joy, satisfaction, self-worth, let it spread. So may all beings in all directions experience and appreciate all their good deeds so that they may experience such joy. All beings north, south, east, west, above and below, in all directions.